Over to you, Jane.
Okay, thank you, Emma. First, I want to thank Emma for all the hard work. I want to salute VASN. I've been a fan for many, many years. So thank you, Erica. Thank you, Gary. Thank you, everyone who's been doing this really exciting work. It's such a pleasure to be able to be here in person for one of these meetings. This is an old school talk. I have no PowerPoint. We actually have the lights on. The reason is that my clinic, that my university that I work with, has very stringent rules about patient confidentiality. I will not be using the real names of any clients or any animal patients. Eventually, in this longer project, I will have to get permission from, in any room, there might be 10 people in the room in a clinic visit, 4 students, 2 veterinary nurses, the clients, of course, the animal patient as well, and some administrative permissions as well. So I hope that when I'm talking about some of the moments here, that I can bring them alive for you, because it'll just be up to me. I won't have any visuals. So if you've been streaming any US reality TV lately here in the UK, you may have noticed a new spate of medical shows, those focused on animal patients, not human ones. In the last couple of years, we've seen the growth of this new subgenre. There's Dr. Jeff, the Rocky Mountain vet with sort of scraggly ponytail. There's the Alaska flying vet, Dr. D, who zips in and out of small communities in her tiny Piper Cub plane. Or there's the trio in the show called A Vet's Life, featuring 3 African-American vets, Doctors Ross, Blue, and Levine, who run a large practice together in Houston, Texas. All of these series build their narratives around the drama of danger and the saving grace of medicine, concentrated in the knowledge of highly trained professionals working in more or less challenging circumstances. The animals are central, of course, but they rarely are the star of the narrative. Most medical cases are resolved happily within the limit of the episode. The larger issues of infrastructure, economics, ideologies of care, and presumptions about what medicine and science are rarely get foregrounded in these narratives. But what if we look beyond the media to the actual practice of veterinary medicine in the United States today? My current project for a new book on the cultural dimensions of veterinary medicine sits at the juncture of animal studies and the medical humanities, a field usually focused almost solely on humans. Yet the practice of veterinary medicine in general, and the space of the veterinary clinic in particular, offers us a privileged realm, not only for deepening our understanding of contemporary U.S. relations between humans and animals, but of medicine more broadly. It frames a hyper-concentrated articulation of relationality, of ethics, of responsibility, of understanding, and of incomprehensibility between human and non-human animals, in a particular historical moment and within and across specific communities. These communities are complex, as we all know. They are marked by economic stratification. They are shaped by cultural, religious, ethical, and familial beliefs, as well as by other dimensions of lived experience, like race, gender, nation, generation. These social relations are enmeshed in, but not fully dictated by, the institutionalized professional work structures of veterinary medical practice, structures both strikingly like and unlike human medicine. The space of the veterinary clinic and what happens there is one of the key sites where this swirling complex of presumptions, hopes, fears, histories, beliefs, and practices are all brought to bear and focused on a single question: how is my pet? In the section that follows, I want to limit my remarks to companion animal medicine, that is, the care of owned animals kept largely for companionship. I'm excluding from this discussion veterinary relations with so-called production animals, those raised for their bodily products. Those populations and the doctors that care for them demand their own theorizations. In addition, I limit my discussion and claims to the US context. Formal veterinary training varies quite a bit from country to country, and it coexists with distinct varieties of human medical practice. And finally, I recognize that the care of animal health takes place in many other settings outside the formal veterinary medical establishment, and my discussion today also will not take up those disparate realms. If the U.S. Veterinary Clinic offers a concentrated site for the articulation of human work relations with animals, then what might be some of the most intellectually productive ways of theorizing that space and the relations there? And what research methodologies might we use? Foucault's work on biopolitics and medicalization in his books like Birth of a Clinic, of course, surely provide a place to start. He posits the modern clinic as a site for the production of subjects and knowledge, largely in service to the state and those who dominate it. This may be useful to us for, since the contemporary veterinary clinic is a medical clinic, caught in the dominant epistemes of its time regarding notions of scientific truth and its relation to, quote, medicine and, quote, the medical gaze. But this framing also demands a careful historical parsing of the notion of the animal as a subject and or as an object slash property. And many people in this room have done wonderful work on those topics. Those concepts undergird the elaboration of legal, medical, and semiotic realms as they articulate what are deemed acceptable and unacceptable relations between human and non-human animals, and of course, even who or, quote, what are parsed into those two categories of living matter. The practice of veterinary medicine today consists of techniques, treatments, and conventions that articulate the possible, probable, and the prohibited at this junction of, quote, medicine and, quote, animals. For instance, euthanasia protocols, limited research funding, lack of available baseline metabolic data for many species, and the creativity demanded in adapting machines and technologies developed for humans to non-human use are some of the results that emanate from this juncture. Compared to human medicine, there are parallels, divergences, and duplications in method, practice, economics, and ethics. Chief among these differences is the obvious fact that the doctor and the patient are not the same species. And I know we have veterinarians and veterinary historians in this office, in this audience, so I'm really excited to have you here at this moment. Therefore, while a Foucauldian approach emphasizing biopolitical production of subjects is useful as we think broadly about veterinary medicine, it might be productive to think of the clinic itself as a multi-species contact zone, drawing on Mary Louise Pratt's widely influential formulation of cultural difference and cross-cultural engagement. In Pratt's formulation, a contact zone is one in which different cultural groups, products, or practices mingle, merge, stand in contradistinction, and sometimes provide the grounds for something new. Drawing on notions from sociolinguistics, such as a contact language, or the rise of, quote, pigeons, that is the language, not the birds, that speakers of different languages developed to communicate with one another, and writing back in 1991, an essay I'm sure many of you are familiar with, The Arts of the Contact Zone, Pratt gives us this working definition of contact zones as the following, quote, spaces where cultures meet, clash, and grapple with each other, often in contexts of highly asymmetrical relations of power, such as colonialism, excuse me, slavery, or their aftermaths as they are lived out in the world today. Later developed more fully in a lot of her other writings, and of course subject to cross-disciplinary critique, this is still, I think, a really useful concept that's been mobilized quite widely among literary and cultural studies scholars. Several components of the encounters of humans and animals in the veterinary clinic can be mapped using a variation of Pratt's formulation. The co-presence that her definition implies with its grappling and clashing is certainly materially foregrounded in the clinic. Slashing talons and sniping beaks certainly make that clear. But so too is the implied notion of negotiation, although Pratt uses the more neutral term to meet. Negotiation in an encounter between members of different species with different experiences of the world, different biologies, different sensoriums, and different communicative modes. In the veterinary clinic, the asymmetry of power is certainly present, but it is also sometimes contestatory, depending on the circumstances and the species. Are we talking about an anaconda, or are we talking about a hamster, a horse, or a kitten? The animal's body will be looked at, listened to, poked, flattened, stretched, every orifice peered into or prodded, sometimes stuck with needles, drugged unconscious for procedures, and at times by doctors and not just owners, petted, cuddled, cooed at, and rewarded with snuggles and treats. Throughout these events, the animal can respond in a variety of ways: compliant, resistant, aggressive, inquisitive, conducting his or her own types of prodding and prodding, tasting and testing, complaining, or sometimes, with apparent terror, retreating for dear life to his carrier or cage. Ultimately, but not always, the veterinarian usually, quote, wins. That is, she succeeds in conducting the type of exam or the treatment she desires by applying restraining techniques of the manual or pharmaceutical kind. So how useful is this multi-species contact zone formulation for what articulates, articulating what happens in a visit to the veterinarian by, say, a pet lizard? To test this out, we have to think methodologically about how to research that question. Recent calls for multi-species ethnography by Ellen Kirksey and others have charted this new conceptual and methodological challenge. My own attempt has involved conducting extensive fieldwork in my university's College of Veterinary Medicine and its attached hospital. And I want to thank here my extraordinarily generous colleagues in that hospital and in that clinic and in those teaching labs. During the last few years, I've been able to sit in on student classes, do clinical rotations among units devoted to necrology, pathology, oncology, all the ologies, imaging, farm animals, critical care, exotic animals, and clinical skills. And for the past academic year, I've been able to spend 2 days a week observing doctors and students, clients and patients on the service devoted to, quote, exotic pets and wildlife medicine. And that is, serving basically everybody but dogs and cats and farm animals, including some zoo animals at nearby zoos. I've seen treatments, assisted in surgery safely. They didn't have me do anything that was at all dangerous. And I've also learned how to break the bad news when the prognosis is grim. In trying to focus ethnographically on the experiences of non-humans, we obviously face many and at times insurmountable barriers. But I felt the first step is to craft a multifocal approach. So while I'm watching what the very compelling doctor is doing and saying, I also must constantly remind myself not only to pay attention to the owner or the guardian if he or she is present, but to the physical, vocal, visual, even the aromatic responses of the non-human in the examination room or treatment suite. So let me share an example. Let's look at the contact zone idea, incorporating the perspective, as best I might imagine it, of a lizard, a juvenile bearded dragon, for example. These desert-dwelling reptiles with striping markings have recently become more popular as pets in the U.S. They're very cute. They have triangle-shaped heads, and they sort of look up at you with an inquisitive look. They seem to invite human interaction. Growing to be less than a foot in length, they are quiet, portable, inexpensive, and attractive. They are, in some ways, the perfect pet. Pet stores are thus providing more, and sometimes with disastrous results for the animal. Hence, veterinarians are seeing more and more of them each day. So here's an example. On June 2nd of this year, a 3-month-old male juvenile bearded dragon, a light sandy-colored fellow with dark chocolate decorative markings, just 3 inches long in body and another 3 in tail, was brought into the clinic again by a local pet store employee. So let's call him, the reptile, Herbie, which is close to his real name, but not exactly. Herbie arrived in a small, clear plastic container with a black plastic top pocked with breathing holes. And we peered down at him through the plastic. He looked up at us, eyeing us back with a tilted head. Herbie had been seen before a couple of weeks ago, and he wasn't growing at an appropriate rate for his age. X-rays, or what the vets call radiographs, had revealed an alarming lack of bone. A diet poor in calcium had made it impossible for the little guy to grow adequate bones, and as a result, his front limbs were so weak that they often splayed out behind him like swimming fins. He scooted around on his stomach. His lower jaw bent during an exam in a way that bone should never waver, but somehow he remained active. So now Herbie was back for a recheck two weeks later, after strict instructions, to dust his crickets with calcium powder right before they were fed to him, to find out if there had been any calcium uptake in the bones that had to be x-rayed. And this was where the comedy and pathos came together in this ethnographic, nearly Chaplin-esque contact zone moment that I want to share with you. First, imagine an animal the size of one of your fingers, and that's not counting the tail, who has no intention of standing still, who is surrounded by humans, giant in relative size. Now imagine trying to set him on the floor of a room where a mobile x-ray machine, which is usually used on horses, can adjust to his small size because they can move it around. Squatting on the cement floor, it's cement because the horses are going to be in there, so it has to be cleaned often. Squatting on the cement floor, wrapped in a lead apron, one of the fabulous veterinary nurses tries to position Herbie securely on a slab of foam. "Don't tape over his corneas," she shouts at her assistant, who is trying to tape him down. Just then, among the 10 students crowded around, someone notices the large floor drain a mere foot away. A gaping maw of steel bars, a foot square. "Don't let him escape down the drain!" At this, howls of laughter escape from all the students watching as the comedy and the pathos of it engulfs us all. Giant humans struggling to contain a tiny patient in a room the size of horses, using technology fitted for someone else, while working against every escape impulse that Herbie must have had triggered by this odd situation. Surely incomprehensible to him in terms of his daily life at the pet store up to this point. The x-ray view from above was safely shot, and then further laughter ensued when it was time to arrange the lateral view, that is, that which is shot not from above, but through the side angle of the body. The laughter was definitely not at Herbie, but at the absurd mismatch between normative techniques, machines, and the particular needs and body of tiny Herbie. There was no way to get the beam low enough to focus on the side of Herbie. He is, after all, only 1/2 inch tall, and he was on the floor. So more comedy as a creative solution comes up. Herbie is then pinned between two brick-like slabs of foam with his tiny snout protruding so he can breathe. "Like a Herbie sandwich," says somebody. And he is rotated 90 degrees so the beam can shoot from above. What was Herbie's top is now his side, and presto, the lateral view is finally obtained. This work of doing contact zone medicine across the species line required ingenuity, creativity, even comedy in a world not built for Herbie, yet ensnaring him in it. Finally, Herbie is done. He is safe, did not escape down the drain, and although surely disoriented from the rotations, perhaps frightened from the event and the restraint, physically, he is none the worse for the wear. In the end, the news for Herbie is encouraging. There was a clear increase in calcium in his bones. He has a chance, and to its credit, the store is paying for this very expensive veterinary care and not just writing him off as a loss, condemning him to death. Yet the store, of course, is clearly the cause of his distress in the first place, raising the legal and ethical questions of when negligence becomes abuse. That's the larger frame in which Herbie comes to the clinic. But how can we really try to understand his experience there? For some species, we have cortisol measures of stress, or a relatively reliable understanding of their body language, ears back, snarling, that may indicate fear, aggression. But with Herbie, like with many other animals, and especially in the exotics clinic where I was observing, we may know little, and even some may presume there is little to know. Little of an inner life or consciousness, little subjectivity, few outer signs of response. In attempting multi-species ethnography, we have to confront our ignorance, but I hope not let it paralyze us. I may never understand Herbie's world. Indeed, I can only attempt to do so through the by definition anthropocentric frame of my own human experience and thought in the world. But I can turn my ethnographic gaze equally on him, as well as on the human actors in the space, giving him my full attention. That attending to is a first step, at least, in deepening our understanding of the clinic as a multi-species contact zone. Thank you.
Thank you.